beyond description. I mean, you just can't imagine the change that took place in such a short period of time.
Eagle residents confront the worst flooding in recent memory. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 5th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, too much sea ice halts spring whaling.
I see a bunch of ice and lots of ridges, and I can see for miles and miles of ice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
An ice jam on the Yukon River is causing major flooding in Eagle. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says both old and new areas of the historic Riverside City and Native Village are being affected.
There's about 12 homes damaged in the old part of the village and 8 to 10 homes affected in the new part of the village. And there's a lot of ice and debris moving around that's come out of the river.
Plum says the Weather Service and state emergency management officials plan to fly into the village today. Longtime Eagle resident John Borg says the river began breaking up at around 7 Sunday night, but stopped moving by 1 a.m. Monday when the ice jam formed.
There's water running on Front Street at about 3 feet deep. The retaining wall is completely under ice and water. And looking across the river, it's nothing but jumble at head height. And so far, it hasn't compromised and pushed into the buildings in town.
Borg says the ice jam has locked up a more than 10-mile stretch of the Yukon, and that there's concern that snow melt and pan ice from upstream will make the situation worse. The river had risen 25 vertical feet at Eagle as of this afternoon. Borg calls it the worst flooding the community has experienced in recorded history.
It's beyond description. I mean, you just can't imagine the change that took place in such a short period of time. The only thing that even comes here is a 37 flood, but it was jammed up shortly below town and it went out before long. It didn't last as long as what this one appears is going to do because we have so much thick ice. The river itself, river ice itself was not ready for this warm weather deluge that took place.
Borg, who's taken in 7 displaced residents, says those flooded out have found refuge with other community members and no one has been injured. He says the community well and airport remain above the flood water. Breakup on the Kuskokwim River is also flooding some upriver villages. Red Devil was nearly evacuated this weekend before water levels there began to recede. Now the village of Aniak is experiencing high waters. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
The ice on the river was thick and the snow in the mountains was deep, and now it's all melting. Aniak resident Brad Allen got a firsthand look at the results.
The ice was pushing, you know, between 15 and 20 miles an hour, and just a massive volume of ice, as well as the water level came up when the ice started going out.
If that ice would have kept going, there wouldn't have been a problem, but it didn't.
It's a pretty significant ice jam just below Aniak.
That's Ben Bach. He's a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He says the strong current is a result of a rapid warm-up.
We think that's largely due to a lot of tributaries that were contributing significant amounts of snowmelt runoff during this warm stretch of weather.
The ice jam is causing water to back up, and that water flooded Aniak today. Allen is the superintendent for the Gus Buck School District. With water up to 4 feet deep in some sections of town, the district closed school for the day.
We didn't want to endanger any students, getting them out to go to school, as well as both one of our schools, the high school, is an evacuation center. So, you know, we would rather have it be an evacuation center rather than a school today as needed.
Farther up the Kuskokwim, the village of Red Devil is hoping the worst is behind them. Water there entered at least 2 homes over the weekend.
Yeah, it inundated the whole village.
Ted Gordon is a resident of Red Devil. He lives about 35 feet from the riverbank.
I had to throw a motor on a boat and then go up and rescue some people from upriver.
Gordon says the water level was rising by the minute. Without adequate time to thaw the ice, large chunks of it were floating down.
We were pretty worried about having the ice jump in the bank and then coming over and smashing a house, so I sacrificed one of my old trucks and parked it out in front. I figured better to have it bumped the truck, then bumped the house.
Water submerged both of Gordon's trucks. After spending the day moving people and possessions to higher ground, he was exhausted. That's when his wife told him the water had reached the top step of their entrance.
I just told myself, well, I'm going to sit down and have a cup of coffee, cigarette, sat down, and within half the cigarette and half a cup of coffee, you know, I went out there and looked, and it had already dropped about 3 to 4 inches.
The ice jam below the village had broken free. By then, the Alaska National Guard's Black Hawk helicopter had found a place to land as part of an evacuation effort.
By the time they got here and they were finally able to land, and I guess they asked a few people, and they said they would rather go home because the water was receding by the time they were able to land.
In the end, no one had to evacuate Red Devil, but that doesn't mean it's safe along the rest of the Kuskokwim. The ice jam that is backing up water in Aniak is loosening, but there's another bend that will likely catch it. Again, hydrologist Ben Balk.
When this jam does release, and that it's likely to jam up again at the typical jam point of Birch Crossing, below Birch Crossing to Kalskag, the ice is still intact. It's still looking pretty solid.
Further downriver, Bethel Search and Rescue is urging travelers to stay off the river. The strong current is forcing open holes in the ice sheet. Bethel Search and Rescue President Peter Achak.
Very dangerous to be on the river at this time because it's melting so fast. You might be passing through an area at one time, and then several hours later, it will be open water.
Achak says downriver communities are also at risk of flooding.
People need to get together, have a meeting in each village, and then develop a plan of action in the event the water rises.
Reporting in Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
This year's abrupt breakup has left the ground muddy, but officials say that doesn't preclude the chance for wildfire. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says fire potential can elevate rapidly.
When we get these warm temperatures, the fine fuels, the grasses, small shrubs and brush and things like that can dry out very, very quickly. And when there's an ignition source, somebody out camping, fireworks, they're out burning or something like that, they're not prepared, they can be quite surprised. A fire can get started and it can take off.
Stockdale says there have already been more than 20 wildfires in Alaska, all human-caused. He says state and federal fire operations are still ramping up, but crews are ready to respond, including 74 smoke jumpers based out of the operations hub at Fort Wainwright. Fairbanks Green Energy Maverick Bernie Carl has achieved another breakthrough. Carl, who pioneered the world's first low-temperature geothermal power plant with United Technologies at his Chena Hot Springs Resort, has adapted the technology to a portable unit. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The generator was on display this week during a statewide geothermal energy conference at Chena Hot Springs Resort. The trailerable power plant is designed to generate electricity using warm water that comes to the surface with crude oil production. Hot Springs owner and clean energy developer Bernie Carl described the prototype, which is being prepared for shipment to Quantum Resources in Jay, Florida.
It's the same type of ORC that we have inside, organic Rankine cycle. It comes from United Technologies. Now, we've modified it so that, first of all, it's portable. It's not over height. It's not overweight. And what's significant about it is that we're going to take oil and gas right from the oil field in Jay, Florida. Now, the oil, it's 95% water, 5% oil at 180 degrees. From the time we get on site until the time we're hooked up, running 1 hour.
Carl says he wanted to demonstrate the generator at an Alaska oil field, but could not work out a deal with in-state producers. He says they remain interested in the project, as do a number of other entities around the state and world. He plans to manufacture the portable geothermal generators locally and sell them for around $600,000, a cost he says can be recovered quickly with power generation savings. Alaska Center for Energy and Power Director Gwen Holdman, an engineer who worked on the original geothermal power plant at Chena Hot Springs, says the technology has broad applicability anywhere there's waste heat, including conventional power plants. Holdman says the generators use basic refrigeration technology backwards.
So instead of having electric power going in and you're creating hot and cold, you start with the hot and cold and then you're using that to create the electric power. So the refrigeration system's running in reverse. We're good at refrigeration in this country. We've been doing it for a very long time, and just modifying that equipment for power generation is really the step that's being taken now.
Southern Methodist University Geothermal Research Laboratory Coordinator Maria Richards says it makes sense to work with oil companies because they've already taken the most expensive step in geothermal development, drilling wells. Richard says Alaska oil fields are well positioned to take advantage of geothermal energy.
If you look at the fact that most of the oil and gas is either on the North Slope or in the, you know, Cook Inlet, close enough that you could be using that for your population centers with transmission lines from there.
Richard says power generation isn't the only option, noting that space heating and cooling are proven applications. Richard says rising fossil fuel prices and environmental concerns are driving innovation and development of what has been a fringe technology. Bernie Carl says he's aiming big with his next geothermal project.
We're drilling a deep hole here, 3,000 feet starting next week. Once the results are in that, I think you'll see a new 1-megawatt generator being developed with United Technologies. It'll be running right here in this power plant. I think you'll see 10 of them by the end of next year. And I think all that power will be going to Eielson Air Force Base.
Carl says he hopes to work a deal to sell power to Eielson by way of a transmission line run from Chena Hot Springs to the Air Force Base near North Pole. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unexpected rival for the ferry Lakanti.
When I saw what took place, I was like, there's no way the ships are going to sail again.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Mount Redoubt has been ramping up seismic intensity with stronger tremors and more frequent earthquakes over the last 2 days. Alaska Volcano Observatory geophysicist Dave Schneider says, although the AVO has not yet changed the aviation alert level from orange, the lava dome that started building after the last big eruption April 4th is getting larger and more unstable.
This thing is somewhere on the order of in excess of about 20 million cubic meters. Which is quite a large volume, probably comparable to the largest domes that were produced during the 1989-90 eruption.
Schneider says there are two ways the dome could be released. It could erupt or collapse and flow down the side of Redoubt Mountain. Schneider says a collapse rather than an explosive event would not necessarily mean there would be less ash flung into the atmosphere.
That heat will be released as the rock fragments and allow the ash to rise up, pretty high, up 35,000 feet. In fact, if you're familiar with the AVO logo, it's one of the events from 1990 at Redoubt, and there's a big mushroom cloud, and that was essentially produced by a dome collapse type of event. So just because it collapses, that does not mean that ash won't be produced. It'll just be produced by a different mechanism.
The other scenario is if the growing dome plugs the system
and allows pressure to accumulate, deep, within the volcano itself, and essentially, you can think of sort of uncorking a champagne bottle. As the volatiles continue to accumulate, it could actually blast that thing out of there without there being a gravitational failure.
Schneider says two flights were heading out for Redoubt today. One crew planned to collect ash from the previous eruptions, and another crew is collecting gas emissions during an overflight. Although Savunga whalers have had three successful bowhead strikes this whaling season, crews in Barrow and other villages to the north are having a difficult time just getting out to open water. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
Janice Meadows is executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in Barrow. She says a glance out her third floor window tells the story.
I see a bunch of ice and lots of ridges. That means the ice has been knocked in towards town, and I can see for miles and miles of ice.
Whaling started in mid-April, but so far, Barrow crews have had no chance to get past huge ridges of ice pressing on shore. Whaling Captain Eugene Brower, who heads the Barrow Whaling Captains Association, says the crews are ready and waiting in whaling camps.
And they're waiting for the ideal weather conditions to blow the ice out. When it first went out in middle part of April, and the whales were migrating north. But after that, the wind shifted to south-southwest winds and brought the polar pack in. And it's been open and closing quite regularly, and so far it's been closed. Then we had this heat wave for about almost a week. We had melting. Last week was melting quite a bit here. But still no open water.
He says they need northeast winds to open up a fracture in the polar pack. Brower says that when the wind shifts, crews will get busy unless the recent high temperatures pose an additional threat.
Well, it all depends how fast the ice is melting or how safe it is to be out there. And very thin ice this year. There's some good spots where it was 3 to 4 feet thick, and some areas only about a foot thick or less. So it all depends on the conditions of the ice when she finally opens up.
Cape Prince of Wales, Little Diomede, Kivalina, Point Hope, Point Lay, and Wainwright are all at the mercy of the winds, Brower says. Savunga has had better luck. That village was not affected by the stubborn ice in mid-April. Savunga crews made the community's first strike on April 15th. George Nuungwuk is the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission vice chairman. He's one of 32 registered whaling captains in Savunga.
We just got done with our spring whaling season. Everybody's back because the ice came in. Now we're concentrating on getting walrus and bearded seals right now. But we were successful in landing 3 bowheads this spring. It's all of them around 40 feet in length, mid-sized whales.
Nuungwuk says there are around 1,600 people in and around Savunga and Gamble.
We share the muktuk and meat with some of our relatives and also our friends, you know, close by, like in Nome and Anchorage and some of the other outlying communities.
Each bowhead contributes about 40 tons of meat to the villages. Savunga is allowed 8 strikes each season. Nuungwuk says unused strikes can be transferred to other villages that need them. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Stimulus funds headed to the Bureau of Land Management in Alaska will pay for removing an old wellhead in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. They'll also help clean up abandoned mines and restore habitats, trails, and roads on federal land. Senator Mark Begich's office announced today that Alaska is slated to receive more than $37 million for 30 BLM projects across the state. The largest portion will pay for the Drew Point well plugging and site remediation. It's an old exploratory well drilled in 1978 in the NPRA and is located about 70 miles southeast of Barrow. BLM Environmental Program Manager Wayne Svenoa in Anchorage says it's a high priority because it's in an erosion area.
There was one storm event where approximately 70 to 90 foot of shoreline was actually lost in a period of 1 week. And so this area is subjected to mass wasting, where there's a large vertical bank that is being exposed. The permafrost is melting, and the erosion from the ocean is undermining that permafrost, and so it's falling into the ocean in large chunks.
Svenoa says BLM will hire a contractor to remove the 12,000 gallons of diesel still in the well bore and remove the contents of the reserve pit. He hopes the work will be completed by next winter. More than $26 million will go to the Drew Point project and mine site recovery work. Svenoa says they'll use some of the money to clean up a mercury mine as well as old placer gold mines in the interior.
Some are scattered throughout the state. There is one specific site as far as the Red Devil Mine site on the Kuskokwim River. We're looking at doing some assessment work on that site and dealing with some petroleum contaminations associated with the old tank farm.
Last week, the Obama administration also announced that nearly $100 million in stimulus money will go to Army Corps of Engineers and Army projects. The half for the Army Corps of Engineers will fund projects from Cordova to Nome. It will pay for construction work at harbors in Accutane and Sitka and fund project studies in places like McGrath, Little Diomede, and Whittier.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank, Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has notified TransCanada that their request for pre-filing status has been approved. The letter from FERC Director of Energy Projects, J. Mark Robinson, to TransCanada states this step allows FERC to begin reviewing materials sent by TransCanada before they submit a final application so that staff can better identify issues that need to be addressed in the environmental impact statement. Robinson wrote that he will direct FERC staff to begin working on the TransCanada proposal. The letter acknowledges that TransCanada plans to file their full application in October of 2012. TransCanada has also agreed to fund a third-party contractor to assist the commission in developing the EIS. The other gas line project, Denali, had their pre-filing status approved by FERC in June of 2008. Tomorrow, Anchorage voters decide the city's next mayor in a special runoff election. The extended campaign came about when none of the original 15 candidates on the April 5th ballot won enough votes for an outright victory. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The two finalists are former state legislator Eric Croft and former Anchorage Assembly member Dan Sullivan. Sullivan was the top vote-getter in April with over 25,000 votes for a 43.38%, tantalizingly close to the 45% plus needed to capture the mayor office and avoid a runoff. Croft was second with about 11,500 votes and just under 20%. He has since picked up three endorsements from other candidates, whose total votes could put him in a close race with Sullivan. Much of the two-candidate race has focused on the city's taxes and budget, services and infrastructure, and bears. Bear encounters last summer in municipal parks and residential neighborhoods sparked months of public debate, and that has only grown with candidate forums and the bears emerging from hibernation. Sullivan bills himself as a conservative whose assembly tenure was marked by attempts to restrict the city budget and a try at promoting a city sales tax to reduce property taxes. Croft is opposed to a sales tax and would lessen the property tax burden by increasing residential exemptions, covering that reduced revenue by seeking other property tax-paying sources. The two candidates disagree over just where that shifted burden would fall. Since 1990, Anchorage mayoral runoff elections with their sole race ballots have posted pretty good, if falling, turnouts. In 1990, it was 50%, in 1994, 40%, and in 2000, 35%. Municipal Elections Director Guadalupe American characterized this year's early absentee vote as going big. As of Sunday, there were nearly 3,300 absentee in person and just under 2,100 absentee by mail ballots returned. The new mayor will take office July 1st. This is Len Anderson in Anchorage.
Changes are afoot for the MV LeConte. The 235-foot ferry joined the Alaska Marine Highway System in the early 1970s and sailed southeast continuously. In 2004, the vessel hit Kosciuszko Reef and was out of commission for 9 months. In 2006, concerns about crew fatigue led Marine Highway officials to make the LeConte a day boat. It's been a long trip for the ship, but as KTOO's Rebecca Shear reports, Friday, the LeConte returned to its roots.
LeConte is like the little train that could. It just keeps on chugging.
And Rick Diesing should know. He's the LeConte's ordinary seaman. And that's not a judgment, by the way. That's his title.
I would be like the ship's utility person because I do all sorts of jobs.
Diesing's worked on the LeConte since 1978. So he's experienced nearly all the ferry's ups and downs, both literal.
I've been in 25-foot seas in this ship. Thrills by the second.
And figurative.
It's like there's always something going on, and it survived.
Like the 2004 grounding, when two massive gashes on the keel led to 9 months and $4 million worth of repairs. Or the 2006 switch to a day schedule, when the ferry dropped 9 crew members and cut service to Sitka. And Deesing believes this little train that could will survive the next thing going on, too.
Since the fair weather's broke and their engine's not going to be back in order, they're going to turn us back into a 24/7 boat.
The Fairweather, one of the Marine Highway System's 2 fast ferries, has been in a $5 million federally funded overhaul since October 1st. Its sister ship, the Chenega, filled in all winter. But with the Chenega heading home to Prince William Sound for the summer, the Lacani is stepping in.
Pelican is every other Tuesday, so that has remained the same. And we are still servicing Lynn Canal as well, 2 days a week. So basically, the big impact is 2 days a week we've implemented through the villages to Sitka.
Including a 9-hour layover in Sitka, home to Southeast Alaska Regional Health Center and other businesses villagers have come to rely on. And AMHS schedule coordinator Carrie Trout says people are thrilled.
Sitka is definitely excited that the village folks are having a layover time there where they can shop and conduct their business. And the villages are happy about it.
Of course, with the fair weather, Sitka got 3 weekly stops, not 2. But Trout says she hasn't heard many negative remarks. Still, people shouldn't get too excited because the Lacani's new schedule,
we're going to do that for 6 weeks,
isn't permanent.
Hopefully we'll have the fair weather back by June 7th.
Hopefully, says AMHS General Manager Captain John Falvey, because actually the fair weather was supposed to be back
on May 1st, okay? So right now we're about 6 weeks late.
See, they're not just slapping on a new coat of paint. They're tearing down and rebuilding entire engines.
What we call 595 series engines.
They're high horsepower, lightweight, extremely rare.
A couple hundred of them probably worldwide.
But most important,
these engines are no longer in production.
So the parts they need for the fair weather have to be manufactured.
And we have one source, MTU, the German engine manufacturer in Germany.
Hence the delay. But Falvey says they've learned some important lessons. And when they rebuild the Chenega's 595 series engines next winter, they'll plan ahead. Falvey thinks it wouldn't be efficient or economical to keep the Lacani on this new run-rest schedule beyond the proposed 6 weeks. But ordinary seaman Rick Deesing says if any ship could do it, it's this one. Back in 2004, he was among the crew flown out to help with the grounding.
When I saw what took place, I was like, there's no way the ship's ever going to sail again. And this guy from Lloyd's of London, he was a very cool Scottish guy that was assessing the damage. And he goes, I understand you've been here a long time. I said, yes, I have. He goes, I want to guarantee you the old girl will sail again. This ship will sail again.
And she did. Even better than before, Deesing says, what with all the new engines, electronics, and safety devices installed on board, making the Lacani, or so this ordinary seaman believes, an anything but ordinary ship. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Weird reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell HKM, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowellhkm.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The new AT&T, your world, delivered.
And by
EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and a sustainable salmon population in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/Copper River.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.